Now, it's tough. First thing in the morning, I hope you all got some coffee, maybe some donuts, maybe not too many donuts, because in 20 minutes, your glucose level is going to crash and you're going to be snoring. But hopefully you're nice and awake, because we need to lay some foundations. The fact of the matter is, one of the reasons that Islam does not ring the bells of the hearts of many evangelicals and reformed folks is because we don't know anything about it. I mean, honestly, most Christians don't even know whether Islam came before or after Christianity, or what the relationship is, or all we've heard about Muhammad are a few things here and a few things there. And as a result, because of our ignorance, that feeds our fear. And so I need to at least try to give you some grounding to have some understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about the Quran. I apologize, I brought my Arabic Quran with me all the way from Phoenix and left it in my hotel room. I was going to pass it around amongst you, but unfortunately, that's not gonna work. But I do want to give you some background in regards to Muhammad, some background in regards to the Quran, before we look at what the Quran says to you and I, because you and I are addressed directly in the pages of the Quran. So let's talk a little bit about Muhammad. We need to recognize that for most Muslims, the subject of Muhammad is extremely sensitive. You certainly have picked that up in the media. You remember the Danish cartoon controversy, where someone collected cartoons about Muhammad, and there was rioting all around the world, and that kind of thing happens, unfortunately, very, very regularly. And there is this massive emotional response to any type of criticism of Muhammad. Part of that is because the vast majority of the criticism that at least Muslims in the West hear about Muhammad is based upon an a-contextual, a-historical criticism of the man, rather than looking at him where he was and understanding who he was and doing that in a fair and accurate manner. And just as we don't appreciate being misrepresented, we need to recognize the Muslims don't like being misrepresented either. Now, Muhammad was a man of Mecca. Mecca, at the beginning of the 7th century, was a relatively small city that was primarily supported by caravan trade. It had to be. It was in a desert region that could not possibly grow enough food or provide enough sustenance for its inhabitants. And so the caravan trade was the means by which it survived. And there in Mecca, you had this type of interaction between the deep desert Bedouin tribes up into Christian Syria via the caravans. And there was in the city of Mecca, the Kaaba. You saw the modern representation of that today. Modern Muslims believe it was founded by Abraham and Ishmael. There is no historical evidence whatsoever of that. No reason to believe that Abraham ever went that far down into the Arabian Peninsula, but that's the Muslim understanding. And but by the time of Muhammad, it was a place of idolatry. He was a part of the Quraysh tribe. The Quraysh tribe controlled the Kaaba and therefore profited from the people who would come. And interestingly enough, would walk around the Kaaba 7 times, frequently naked, in the worship of the gods, the 360 idols that were in the Kaaba. And this is what was going on in Mecca at that particular point in time. Now, Muhammad, as a young man, we know, according to the hadith, and let me define the hadith for you. This is very important. I'll be mentioning this a number of times over the course of today. The hadith, and again, I'm primarily addressing Sunni Islam, not the Shiites. They have a separate body of hadith that differs a lot from the Sunni hadith. The hadith are the sayings, statements, and actions of Muhammad and his companions. And these have been collected together over about a 300-year period after the death of Muhammad. There, for the Sunni, there are about 6 really authoritative collections, 5 or 6 collections of hadith. The 2 most authoritative are called Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Sahih al-Bukhari is about 9 volumes long, Arabic and English. Sahih Muslim is about 8 volumes long. You have Sunan Abu Dawud, Jami' at-Tirmidhi, other collections that are a little bit smaller. These together comprise thousands of statements and actions, stories from the life of Muhammad and his companions. That collection of literature becomes the context in which the Quran is understood, becomes the commentary on the Quran, and you from that derive the Sharia, the Islamic law that is such a point of controversy today. Okay, so according to the hadith and according to the early Sunnah, the early lives of Muhammad, such as that of Ibn Ishaq. Muhammad was considered to be a particularly honest young man. He was involved in the caravan trade up into Christian Syria. He would have had at least encounters with both Christians and Jews within that type of a context. But he was troubled by the polytheism of Mecca. He was troubled by the polytheistic religious worship. He was troubled by the injustice that existed in his society, again, according to these early stories. And so he would frequently retreat into a cave for lengthy periods of contemplation. As a young man, he befriended an older woman, Khadija, who proposed to him marriage. And so they were married. He was about 15 years or her younger. She had a fair amount of money, and so he was entrusted with her state of affairs and things like that. And during one of these times, when after his marriage to Khadija, he is in the cave, he has an experience, and this is the beginning of Islam. This is in 610 AD, so we're talking over 600 years after the birth of Christ. And in the cave, Muhammad encounters the angel Jibril, and that's Angel Gabriel, as we would refer to him. And he is told to proclaim or to read. And he says, well, I cannot. I'm an unlettered man. And the angel grabs him and squeezes him until he thinks he's going to die. And this happens three times. And finally, the angel then reveals to him the very first portion of the Quran. Now, just in passing, let me mention to you, if you ever decide to read the Quran is only a little bit over half the length of the New Testament. It is only 14% the length of the entire Bible. So it is a rather short work. And if you ever decide to read it, whatever you do, don't do what the CNN reporters were doing on 9/11, where they went running into various Barnes & Noble's bookstores and started buying up Qurans and started leafing through them to try to find something that they could add to their report, which they didn't find anything to add to their report because they couldn't understand what in the world the book was saying. If you try to read it from beginning to end, you're going to have the same experience because it really wasn't designed to be read that way. It really wasn't designed to be read in the way you and I would understand reading a book in the first place. The Quran is made up of 114 surahs, as we'll mention later on, and they are in order of length. So if you start reading from the beginning, you're going to be jumping back and forth between different periods in Muhammad's life, and it's just not going to make any sense to you whatsoever. In my book on the Quran, I provide a chart which gives you about the best guess that we can come up with as to the order of the surahs. If you use that chart, at least you'll be reading in a chronological order during the life of Muhammad. It'll make a whole lot more sense to you, but we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move on. So this first section of the Quran is not Surah 1. It is Surah 96. Surah 96, 1 through 5 says, "Proclaim or read in the name of thy Lord and Cherisher, who created man out of a mere clot of congealed blood. Proclaim, and thy Lord is most bountiful. He who taught the use of the pen taught man that which he knew not." So there are the first words. Now, the entirety of the Quran is not given to Muhammad at this point in time. According to the Islamic understanding, the entire Quran came down on what's called Laylat al-Qadr. Laylat al-Qadr is the night of power during the month of Ramadan. According to most Muslims' belief, Laylat al-Qadr occurs either on the 21st, 23rd, 25th, 27th, or 29th day, evening, night of Ramadan. And Muhammad knew which night it was. He was going to come out and tell the people. When he came outside, according to the hadith, they were arguing with one another, and hence he was caused to forget to tell them which night it was. And so they have to guess as to which night Laylat al-Qadr is. Prayers offered on the night of Laylat al-Qadr are thousands of times more effective than on any other night of the year. So many Muslims will stay up all night on the odd-numbered nights of Ramadan praying, knowing that at least one of those nights is Laylat al-Qadr, and that would be much more effective for them. And so the Quran came down all in one night. It was given to the angel Jibril in one night on Laylat al-Qadr. But then between 610 and 632, so for 22 years, these portions of the Quran are given to Muhammad. They are dictated to him. He then dictates them to his followers. And that is how the Quran comes down to mankind over the course of 22 years. Now, since it starts there, remembering that Muhammad is a minority prophet in Mecca from 610 to 622. When I say minority, what that means is he is a monotheist preaching against the prevailing polytheism. And so there are many people who want him killed. According to the Islamic story, he is abused very often. He is mistreated very often. There is a story where he was bowed in prostration in prayer. Some of his enemies came along and dumped the entrails of a camel on his back. He just stayed in that position until his daughter Fatima came along and pulled the entrails off of his body. Interestingly enough, the story always goes on to point out that all the men that did that by name ended up being killed. So it's not like, well, there's a forgiveness story here. There's more of a vengeance story. But there is persecution of the Muslims. And during this period of time, Muhammad is protected by his uncle Abu Talib. His uncle Abu Talib. Keep that name in mind if I can remember to do so. There is an important story to tell about Abu Talib later on in my presentation. Eventually, Muhammad and his followers flee from Mecca to the city of Yathrib, which is then renamed to Medina, the city of the Prophet, in 622 AD, which becomes the year of Hijra, and that becomes the beginning of the Islamic calendar. The Islamic calendar begins in 622, and remember, of course, since it's based upon a lunar calendar rather than a solar calendar, the Islamic year is not just 1,400 years added to that or something like that. It changes because of the different length of the year. It's a little bit difficult to historically put all those things together. Now, once he gets to Medina, there's a new reality. Instead of being a minority prophet, a persecuted person, he now is Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. He unites the tribes there in Medina. They have to fight against the Meccans. During this time is a number of battles that take place, such as the Battle of Badr, the Battle of Uhud, and the Battle of the Trench in a fairly short period of time. Many of the Islamic stories of Muhammad's valor in battle and things like that come from these three particular battles that take place, where the Muslims win the first one, sort of lose the second one, win the third one, but sort of in a standoff type thing. There's sort of a balance of power. But the Meccans can realize that their days are numbered because Muhammad is uniting many of the Bedouin tribes, the deep desert tribes, under this new banner of Islam. And so it's during this time that you have the destruction of the Banu Qurayza, a Jewish tribe, who betray Muhammad in the defense of Medina. And so after the battle, Muhammad has his armies surround this particular group. They surrender. Their women and children are sold into slavery, and Muhammad presides over the beheading of over 800 men in one day. This takes place in the destruction of the Banu Qurayza. Finally, in 628 AD, you have the truce of Hudaybiyah, where Muhammad and the Medinans, the Muslims, go to Mecca. They want to engage in Hajj. They want to circumambulate the Kaaba. The Meccans do not allow them in, but they sign a treaty with them. And many of the Muslims are very disappointed by this. They thought Muhammad had said that they were going to be able to finally do this. Muhammad realizes that this really is politically expedient for him, and is going to lead in a very short order to the subjugation of Mecca in 630, where the Muslims, in a pretty much bloodless way, enter into Mecca, take over Mecca. Only a couple of dozen people are killed at the orders of Muhammad, primarily poets who had written against him. He had a real problem with people like that. And Mecca becomes the very heart and soul of the Islamic Empire, though Muhammad goes back to Medina, and he dies in Medina at a fairly young age, only in his early 60s, 62, 64. We're not totally certain exactly how old he was, but he dies in Medina in 632 AD. Now, as you probably are aware, 632 to 732 becomes the century of Islamic expansion. It's exactly 100 years later. The Islamic expansion is stopped. The Battle of Tours, Charles Martel ends the Islamic expansion upward out of North Africa, across the Straits of Gibraltar, through Portugal, Spain, into France. The empire has spread all across North Africa, all the way through the Holy Lands, up into the Greek areas, across what we would call today Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera, and out toward India. It's a huge expansion in a very, very short period of time, and it's very important in church history as well. I can't go into that right now, but if you ever study church history, always keep in mind the impact of the loss of North Africa and many Christian lands at that particular time, due to the rise of Islam. Now, there's some key theological events in the life of Muhammad you should be aware of. Normally, what you hear, and I'd like to warn you just on a practical level right now, it is very, very common for you to hear. There are entire websites out there. There are Christian speakers who go around, and they will, as soon as they start talking about Muhammad, they will talk about his marriage to Aisha. This marriage was contracted when Aisha was 6 years of age, and according to all of the meaningful sources in Islamic history, was consummated when Muhammad was about 54 and Aisha was 9. Now, the result of this is that there are entire websites out there that talk about Muhammad the pedophile and everything else. This has to be put in the context in which it took place. There is no evidence whatsoever that Muhammad, the Muslims, the Quran, felt any embarrassment whatsoever about Muhammad's marriage to Aisha. Aisha was the daughter of Abu Bakr, who was his closest friend, his closest confidant, and the next caliph of the Islamic movement. In fact, Aisha becomes mother of the faithful. She is a primary source of hadith narrations concerning Muhammad's life and information concerning his life. And the reality is that the sources indicate that her young age was actually a great advantage to her because she was the only virgin that Muhammad married. All the rest of Muhammad's wives had been married at another time before. And so the Islamic sources show absolutely no concern about this. Now, obviously today, this results in horrible things happening in Islamic lands where child brides are forced to engage in marriage long before they should be able to do so. But back in that day, when lifetimes were much shorter than they are now, this was not an unusual situation. That's not where you want to start, and if you start there, let me guarantee you, you will close off any opportunity of speaking anything to a Muslim because they've just heard it so many times before. It's like going to John 1:1 with Jehovah's Witness before doing anything else. Not a good idea because they're just used to it. They've heard it before. There are much more, I think, important issues to look at in the life of Muhammad, and I would suggest that one of the key theological events has to do with Muhammad and Zainab bint Jahsh. Zainab bint Jahsh was Muhammad's first cousin, and Zainab bint Jahsh was given in marriage by Muhammad to his adopted son, Zayd. There was a close relationship between Muhammad and Zayd. Zayd was a freed slave of Muhammad, and he was adopted as his son. One day, Muhammad went to Zayd's home to speak to him, and the various sources give different spins to the subject, but it seems rather obvious that what happened was that when he knocked on the door, Zainab got up to greet him, and somehow he saw her in a state of undress and was absolutely overtaken with her beauty. I guess she was just knocked down, drag out, gorgeous. And she could tell that he was taken aback by this. There was already problems in the marriage between Zainab and Zayd. Word got to Zayd. Zayd comes to Muhammad and says, "If you want my wife, I will divorce her." And Muhammad says, "No, keep your wife. That would be inappropriate." What happens is an entire revelation, entire verses of the Quran come down from heaven specifically to instruct Muhammad that he is to marry Zainab. And it even says in the Quran, this was to deal with the problem concerning the divorced wives of your adopted sons. Yeah, that was a real big problem they were dealing with, I'm sure. The reality was that in Islamic culture, in Arabic culture, this was considered incestuous. And so in the very text of the Quran, you have verses that in essence command Muhammad to do that, and in the process destroy the godly, good, proper concept of adoption. Adoption does not exist in Islamic law. It does not exist in Islamic lands. It was destroyed by the relationship between Muhammad and Zainab bin Jahsh, so that he could marry the divorced wife of his adopted son, who was no longer his adopted son, because the Quran then commanded them to call them by the names of their real fathers, not by their adopted fathers, destroying the concept of adoption within Islam. Now, given that Muslims believe that the Quran is co-eternal with Allah, it is uncreated, this is a belief that developed over time. It is a belief that there were certain leaders of Islam that did not accept in the first couple of centuries, but it has now become part of Sunni orthodoxy. It's not Shiite orthodoxy, but it's Sunni orthodoxy. Since the Sunnis believe that the Quran is uncreated, it's eternal as Allah himself, the idea is this was written in Arabic on a tablet in heaven from eternity past, that Muhammad was to marry the divorced wife of his no longer adopted son. That to me is one of the clearest examples. In the words of Aisha herself in the hadith, "I fear that your Lord hastens to fulfill your desires." Those are the words of Aisha in regards to how often it was that things would come down from God and be given to Muhammad that just happened to provide him with a way of doing things that no one else could do. For example, the Quran limited Muslim men to four wives, but Muhammad receives a special dispensation to go beyond that. Modern Muslim apologists will say, well, that was political. It was so he could unite the tribes, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but the reality is, again, this reflects upon the very nature of the Quran as it's understood by Muslims to this very day. Something that's also very, very important was the deputation from Najran. According to Islamic sources, there's no record of this to my knowledge from Christian sources, but according to Islamic sources, toward the end of Muhammad's life, a deputation of Christians arrived in Medina, to have a conversation with Muhammad. And some of the results of this disputation and discussion end up in the text of the Quran itself. And we get some idea of Muhammad's understanding, or more importantly, lack of understanding of Christianity as a result of this encounter at Najran. Now, I spend a lot more time on this in the book if you want to read more about it. But let's look at a couple of things that end up in the Quran as a result of this encounter between Muhammad and these Christians from Najran. In the Quran we read, "Behold, thou didst say to one who had received the grace of Allah and thy favor, retain thou in wedlock..." Oh, I'm sorry. How did I get to this? Okay. Back up a second. Here's what the... I forgot that I was going to give you what's in the Quran in regards to Zayd and Zainab. "Retain thou in wedlock thy wife and fear Allah, but thou didst hide in thy heart that which Allah was about to make manifest. Thou didst fear the people, but it is more fitting that thou shouldst fear Allah. Then when Zayd had dissolved his marriage with her with the necessary formality, we joined her in marriage to thee." This is God who joined Zainab to the Prophet. "In order that in future there be no difficulty to the believers in the matter of marriage with the wives of their adopted sons, when the latter have dissolved with the necessary formality their marriage with them, and Allah's command must be fulfilled." Surah 33:37. That is the section of the Quran in regards to Zainab and Zayd. And again, I find it very hard that actually was written in eternity on tablets in heaven. Now, looking at the deputation from Najran, Surah chapter 3, ayahs 59 through 61. In the Quran, a chapter is a surah, a verse is an ayah, if you hear me switching back and forth between the two. "Indeed, the example of Jesus to Allah is like that of Adam. He created him from dust, then he said to him, 'Be,' and he was. The truth is from your Lord, so do not be among the doubters." So what is being said is Jesus is not the Son of God. He is not divine. He has not eternally existed. He was made from dust. He came into existence at the command of Allah. It says the truth is from your Lord, so do not be among the doubters. So if you don't believe that, then you are a doubter. "Then whoever argues with you about it after this knowledge has come to you, say, 'Come, let us call our sons and your sons, our women and your women, ourselves and yourselves. Then supplicate earnestly together and invoke the curse of Allah upon the liars among us.'" So very clearly from the Islamic perspective, this is not a subject where we can have ecumenical dialogues and try to come to some middle ground. If you believe that there is a son of Allah, then you are a liar. And the curse of Allah, lies upon you. It goes on to say, indeed, this is the true narration, and there is no deity except Allah. And indeed, Allah is the exalted and might, the wise. But if they turn away, then indeed, Allah is knowing of the corruptors. So you experience corruption if you continue to believe what Christians believe. Say, O people of the scripture, Alal Kitab, people of the book, come to a word that is equitable between us and you, that we will not worship except Allah and not associate anything with him and not take one another as lords instead of Allah. But if they turn away, then say, bear witness that we are Muslims submitting to him. Now, it's ironic to me that recently, just a few years ago, a paper came out, an ecumenical paper between liberal Muslims and liberal Christians called Common Word. And it comes from this very section where it says, come to a word that is equitable between us and you. Evidently, the liberal Christians didn't seem to understand the context of Surah 3, because what is being said there is actually in reference to calling a curse upon Christians for ascribing a son to Allah, that we will not worship except Allah and not associate anything with him. We're going to see in the next section that the unforgivable sin in Islam is called shirk. The central affirmation of Islamic theology is called tawhid, the oneness of Allah. It's a Unitarian oneness in modern Islamic understanding. So to negate the central heart, the positive affirmation of tawhid, is to engage in shirk, the association of anyone or anything with Allah, and that is the one sin Allah will not forgive. Any other sin, Allah can forgive to you, but he cannot forgive to you the sin of shirk. If you are a mushrik, a person who dies having committed the sin of shirk, there is no forgiveness for you forever. You will be in hellfire. And so that's what's being mentioned here. Do not associate anything with him and not take one another as lords instead of Allah. But if they turn away, then say, bear witness that we are Muslims. We submit to him, which means you do not submit to him. You are not in submission to him. And so that encounter with the Christians from Najran ends up being reflected in the Quran, but clearly the author of the Quran does not understand what the Christians believe regarding the nature of the sonship of Christ, regarding the fact that we're not associating any created thing with God. We believe that the doctrine, that the triune nature of God is eternal, that it is inherent to his nature. It didn't come into existence at a point in time. God has eternally been triune. We're not associating anything to the created order. But the author of the Quran does not understand that that is the case. There is no question about that at all. Now, how does this keep happening? I don't know. But you got to admit, she's awful cute. And her name's Clementine. You know what her middle name is? I had nothing to do with this. It's Clementine James, J-A-Y-M-E-S. Take it up with my daughter and my son-in-law. But she is... Unfortunately, she now lives in Georgia, and I live in Phoenix, so I don't get to see her all that often. So maybe that's why the computer is just helping me out, just to make me smile, you know. Besides that, I'm a first-time grandpa, so laugh. Thank you. Wise man right down there. Good. All right. All right. As I said, 114 surahs, 114 chapters. Surah Al-Fatiha, the first surah in the Quran, is a 7-verse opening prayer. I was talking with a gentleman here who has lived in the Middle East, and he was mentioning how often he's heard the prayers and the calls to prayers. I bet you he could quote most of Surah Al-Fatiha because it's heard in the prayers all the time. The next surah, Surah Al-Baqarah, is the surah of the cow. It's the longest surah. Then Surah 3 is a little bit shorter. Surah 4 is a little bit shorter. It's not perfect as far as numbers of verses, but it's fairly close to the actual length. Keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter until the 114th, which is the shortest of the surahs. But again, if you read it in that order, that means you're jumping back and forth between different periods in Muhammad's life. And even at that, scholars recognize that some of the surahs are made up of materials from different parts of Muhammad's life anyways. So even if you follow the order that I've suggested in the book, you're still going to be encountering some issues of context when you read the Quran. As I said, organized by size, not chronology or topic. It's very difficult to follow context and the background of the Quran. It's really, Muslims handle the Quran very differently than we handle the Bible. Not just in the way that they treat it. It's never to be put under other books. It's always to be elevated up off the floor. If it's on a shelf of books, it's to be on the highest shelf, and so on and so forth. It's to be treated in a respectful manner in that way. But for most Muslims, the Quran is not a text to be studied wherein you encounter the very words of God. It has much more of a magical element to it in the average experience of the Muslim. There are many Muslims in the world that memorize the entire Quran in Arabic. How many of you here have read the Quran? Just a few folks. Normally I have people go like this, parts of it, you know, like that. How many of you read it in Arabic? Yeah, okay. From the Islamic perspective, if you haven't read it in Arabic, you haven't read it. Which means the vast majority of Muslims have never read it, because the vast majority of Muslims cannot read Arabic. But interestingly enough, many Muslims will memorize the entirety of the Quran in Arabic, even though they don't know Arabic, which is an amazing thing to consider, how you could possibly do something like that. But the human mind is a fascinating thing. Unlike the way that... A number of years ago, I was doing some videos that were translated into Farsi and distributed in Iran. After I did a section on Surat Al-Ikhlas, Surah 112, the former Muslims, these are Shiite Muslims, who were doing the videotaping came up to me and they said, the imams never do what you just did. Because I had exegeted the text. I had gone through its background, its context, what the words meant, how are they laid to one another, what can we put together as to what this is saying. And they said, the imams never do that. And so if you're used to expositional preaching, if you're used to someone going to 1 Corinthians and talking about the background in Corinth and Paul's background, the language and the historical setting and the situation going on, and then using that to shed light upon what's going on there in the church, that's not how the Quran is generally handled. And if it is handled that way, it's almost always in Western countries, certainly not in majority Muslim countries. Much more, first of all, part of the reason for that is that for many sections of the Quran, we don't know the background. We don't know the history, we don't know the context. There are some scholars who've said that as much as a third of the Quran in Arabic is basically untranslatable or unknowable as to what it's really talking about. The only reason that there is understanding of what it's talking about is because we have the hadith, we have the commentaries provided by those early sources, which, of course, there's lots of questions as to exactly how accurate those things are. Don't have time to get into hadith studies today. That is something that I have spent some time on, which is an amazing thing. I've found myself riding through the heat at 3 o'clock in the morning in Phoenix, Arizona, listening to lectures on how you analyze hadith. And I always wondered, if I ever get hit by a car, in the middle of the night like this, they're going to pick up my iPod and hear this stuff and immediately call the authorities. Okay, because this guy's weird. He's listening to some very strange stuff, and you all need to come find out what's going on. But the reality is, without the hadith, there's entire sections we wouldn't even know what it was talking about. And so the interpretation of the Quran is very challenging. And interestingly enough, twice now I've been involved in debates where by the end of the debate, I was the one arguing you can actually follow a context through a section of the Quran, and the Muslim was arguing you can't do that. If you want to see an example of this, see my debate with Bassam Zawadi on whether the Quran misrepresents Christianity from London from a couple of years ago. By the end of the debate, I'm saying, look, just listen to what Surah 5 says. Follow the context through. And he's saying, you can't do that. You can't follow a context through. Because if you do, then the Quran will misrepresent Christianity. But you've got to be able to chop those sections up so that you can get around that. So it's a difficult book to interpret. What also makes it very difficult is that from the Islamic perspective, these are the direct words of God, not of men. So for example, we want to ask the question, what did Muhammad understand of the doctrine of the Trinity? From the Islamic perspective, that is a stupid and irrelevant question. It's a stupid and irrelevant question because Muhammad has nothing to do with the Quran. It has nothing to do with the Quran at all. What he understood about the Trinity is utterly and completely irrelevant because the words of the Quran are only God's words. They do not represent his understanding at all. And so when we ask the question, what was Paul's intention here? What was John's intention here? What is John's concern in this text? Something like that. does not enter into Orthodox Islamic interpretation. Now, there are liberal Muslims who deal with issues like that, for example, if you want to look at Nasser Abu Zayd, he was an Egyptian scholar who started to apply that kind of thinking to the Quran. He was forcibly divorced from his wife and is now living in exile in Scandinavia someplace. That's what happens when you apply those types of standards. It doesn't work out real well in regards to that. Now, according to the Islamic perspective, many books were sent down by Allah. Many books were sent down, including the Torah and the Injil. So there's been many revelations given by Allah to people down through the ages, which includes the law and the gospel. Now, what did the writer, this is extremely important, what did the writer of the Quran think the law and the gospel was? I've read the Quran many times. I've read all of Sahih al-Bukhari and all of Sahih Muslim. I don't know very many Christians who have been able to read that amount of the hadith, but I have tried to honestly deal with the materials, and I have found no evidence whatsoever that the author of the Quran had any meaningful first or second-hand knowledge of what is contained in the Old and New Testaments. What's very clear to me, especially in the Quran, is the fact that the author had a oral understanding of what is found in the law and the gospel, not a direct literary understanding. In other words, he had gone on caravan trips up into Syria. On those trips, they would have encountered Jews and Christians. They didn't have CNN or ESPN back then. What you actually did, this is amazing, young people, don't get shocked here, but they actually talked to each other at night around campfires and meals. I know that's sort of scary, no, they were not texting. They were actually talking with their mouths, looking in eyes. It's an amazing thing, the amazing art that has been lost in our society today. I actually will walk into restaurants and see people, and there's a group of friends sitting around the table, and what are they all doing? And then one will go, ha, 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 ha. They're texting each other. They're not talking. This is wrong, okay? This is why most men are 28 years old before they get married now. Okay, and it's only because the women have become desperate by that point in time, and they just don't even know how to talk to a woman anymore. Okay, I'm not going to get into that. Anyways, that's completely different. Don't even know how I got there. We'll move on from there. Anyhow, the point is that he would have had encounters with Jews and Christians, and this is why the Quran includes in its story Jewish mythology and Christian mythology as if they're a part of the Torah and the Injil. For example, there's the story of Jesus speaking from his cradle. Now, if you are going, I don't remember that story in the Bible, it's because it's not in the Bible. It is from the 5th century Arabic infancy gospel, but it shows up in the Quran because the author of the Quran thought it was in the Bible. And you have the story of Jesus forming clay birds and breathing on them, and they become alive and they fly away. And again, the Quran, the author of the Quran thought that was in the Injil, thought it was in the gospel. The reality is that is from the second century infancy gospel of Thomas. So the author of the Quran clearly did not know what was actually in the Old and New Testaments. And of course, from my perspective, if God wrote the Quran, then God knew what was in the Old and New Testament and would not have made those kinds of mistakes. But the Quran itself claims to act as a muhaimin. A guard over the preceding books, and how this is understood then by Muslims today. Muslims believe that the Bible has been radically corrupted. Now, down through history, there were two views amongst Muslims. In those early centuries, there were those who believed in Tarif al-Mana and some who believed in Tarif al-Nas. Tarif al-Mana is a corruption of the meaning and interpretation of the words, but not the words themselves. And this makes more sense to the author of the Quran. I don't believe the author of the Quran believed that the Torah and the Injil had themselves been changed. I just don't think he said that. I think you can make a very strong case against that. The reality is that the Quran says that if it's been sent down by Allah, it cannot be changed. And the Quran says the Torah and the Injil were nutsal. They were sent down by God. And so it would make sense that the author of the Quran would not believe that they could have been changed. But there was another group, Tarif al-Nas, that did believe that the words had been changed. And finally, in the late 1800s, around 1870, an Indian Muslim scholar wrote a book called Itsar al-Haq, the Vindication of the Truth. And that book went to German skepticism and German radical criticism and gathered together every possible contradiction and every possible argument against the Bible. And as a result of that book, the vast majority of Muslims today all across the world believe that the Bible has been radically corrupted and radically changed. And so they interpret what the Quran says about it acting as a muhaimin in the way that Shabir Ali did in that clip that I played for you last night, where I asked him, well, how can we know what's left in the New Testament that's still inspired? And he says, well, if it agrees with the Quran, it's inspired. If it doesn't, it's not. And so it's a completely anachronistic way of taking the Quran, using that as a lens, and then looking through it at our texts that they are really stuck with today. And they're not consistent in their application of standards, but that's another subject for another time. Can't get into it today. Now, the Quran itself is then transmitted by a government-controlled textual transmission. And what I mean by that is, as we're going to see here in a moment, the actual version of the Quran that most Muslims have today was created by Uthman, the third caliph, the third successor of Muhammad. After Muhammad's death, Abu Bakr took over, and then after him, Umar ibn Affan, and then finally, Uthman becomes the third caliph. And he engages in an editing process and enforces that particular version of the Quran. As a result, you have a generally unified textual history because of that. And the 1924 Egyptian edition, viewed by most as the official version in Arabic, is so ubiquitous amongst Muslims that I mentioned to you last evening a Muslim scholar that grew up here in the Houston area, Sheikh Yasser Qadi. And some of you were asking, well, you know, where could I hear Muslims explaining to Muslims what they believe? And I always suggest Sheikh Yasser Qadi's 16 CD series called Light and Guidance. And at one of the points in time, I think in that series, it might have been some other lecture he was doing. I've listened to a lot of his lectures. Normally, he could just simply quote the text in the Quran in the Arabic, just boom, 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 boom. But it was one of those days, didn't have this coffee that morning, I don't know. And that one verse wouldn't come. And so finally, out of frustration, he said, well, it's in Surah, whatever it was, right-hand page at the top. Now, think what that means if you can actually say to people, it's on the right-hand page at the top. That means you're assuming everybody in your audience has the exact same printing of the exact same text. Even if everybody in here had the ESV, you still couldn't do that because there's multiple printings of the ESV. So there is one 1924 Egyptian printing that he could just assume. And again, it'd be the one I would be distributing and letting you look at right now if I remember to bring it from my hotel room. Where he could get away with that, and you could actually find out what he's talking about, because that's where it would be, because all the printings are the same, and that text is going to be on the same page in every printing like that, and that's the 1924 Egyptian printing. There is a major difference between the centralized governmental control of the collation and transmission of the Quranic text and the non-centralized, non-controlled transmission of the New Testament. This is extremely important. I wish I had time to develop this. Maybe sometime I can do my New Testament reliability presentation for you sometime. But I honestly think that the key apologetic issue for people today is to understand where we got the Bible and how we got the Bible. Unfortunately, many evangelicals think the Bible floated down from heaven on a pillow. It was leather-bound, had silver or gold edges on the pages, and might have even had thumb indexing, depending on which perspective you take. That's not how we got the Bible. And if you think that's how the Bible came, with the cross-references already there, and maybe even a few of Charles Ryrie's footnotes along the way, you're going to be sadly disturbed when you encounter the disciples of Bart Ehrman and other people like that. We need to know where the Bible came from. We need to know why we can rely upon it. And especially in talking with Muslims, given that all of them today believe the Bible has been corrupted, we need to be able to give an answer for the hope that's within us on that particular subject. Now, let me read to you from the hadith the story of what happened with the Quran. And I should have just enough time to get through these elements. Abu Bakr then said to me, Umar has come to me and said, casualties were heavy among the Qura of the Quran, i.e. those who knew the Quran by heart, on the day of the Battle of Yalmama. I just always stop there because someone starts laughing. I just figure I'm going to let it pass. We'll let everybody go, the Battle of Yalmama, and then you just move on from there. And I just stop, just let it happen, and then we move on. So anyway, the point is that there were many of the memorizers of the Quran who died on the day of the Battle of Yalmama. And I am afraid that more heavy casualties may take place among the Qura on other battlefields, whereby a large part of the Quran may be lost. I've translated the Arabic. That's an accurate translation of the term that is found there. Obviously, what this means is that in the days of Abu Bakr, this is shortly after the death of Muhammad, the Quran had not yet been collated. It had not yet been brought into a written form. Therefore, I suggest you, Abu Bakr, or the Quran, be collected. So I started looking for the Quran and collecting it from what was written on palm stalks, thin white stones, and also from the men who knew it by heart, till I found the last verse of Surat Al-Tawbah, Surat of Repentance, Surah 9, with Abi Khuzaimi al-Ansari, and I did not find it with anybody other than him. Now, I find that fascinating, that this source is willing to admit this one verse was found with one man in one man's memory. That does make you ask the question, well, were there other verses that were only in one of the memories of the people who died at the Battle of Yamama? Could there be stuff that was lost at that point? Does raise the issue. Then the complete manuscripts, copy of the Quran, remained with Abu Bakr till he died, then with Umar till the end of his life, then with Hafsa, the daughter of Umar. This is Sahih al-Bukhari 6509. 510 goes on to say, Hudhayfa was afraid of the people of Sham and Iraq's differences in the recitation of the Quran. So he said to Uthman, now this is around 650 now, so we've jumped about 20 years down the road. O chief of the believers, save this nation before they differ about the book, the Quran, as Jews and Christians did before. So Uthman sent a message to Hafsa saying, send us the manuscripts of the Quran so that we may compile the Quranic materials in perfect copies and return the manuscripts to you. Hafsa sent it to Uthman. Uthman then ordered Zayd bin Thabit, Abdullah bin Azuzabair, Sayyid bin Alas, and Abdurrahman bin Harith bin Hashim to write the manuscripts in perfect copies. Uthman said to the three Quraishi men, in case you disagree with Zayd bin Thabit on any point of the Quran, then write it in the dialect of the Quraysh. The Quran was revealed in their language because, of course, Muhammad was of the Quraysh tribe. They did so, and when they had written many copies, Uthman returned the original manuscripts to Hafsa. Uthman sent to every Muslim province one copy of what they had copied and ordered that all other Quranic materials, whether written in fragmentary manuscripts or whole copies, be burnt. Now, my Muslim friends come up with all sorts of excuses here. They say, well, you know, that's showing respect. This isn't trying to hide anything. But the problem is Uthman here is specifically trying to enforce one version of the Quran on the entire Islamic community. And the historical sources are very clear there are people who resisted this, specifically a man by the name of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. Ibn Mas'ud was one of the four men that Muhammad himself had said, if you want to know the Quran, go to Ibn Mas'ud. And Ibn Mas'ud even told his followers, do not take those manuscripts, keep your manuscripts, hide them. So there was a division amongst the early Muslims on this particular issue. And that's why these materials were being burnt, was to provide this one version. And Zayd bin Thabit added, a verse from Surat Azab was missed by me when we copied the Quran, and I used to hear Allah's apostle reciting it. So we searched for it and found it with Khuzaimi bin Thabit al-Ansari. The verse was, among the believers are men who have been true in their covenant with Allah, which is Surah 33:23. That's Sahih al-Bukhari 6:5:10. Now, here you have the creation of the final version of the Quran, the Uthmanic revision. And I don't have time, unfortunately, to develop this. But this is extremely important. This was really the focus of the debate that I had with Islamic apologist Yusuf Ismail at Northwest University, the former Potchefstroom University in Potchefstroom, South Africa, just a few weeks ago. And we are working on getting those videos available. And when they're available, we'll certainly let you know at aomin.org so you can see the dialogue that took place on this particular subject. Now, other sources shed some interesting light here. Ibn Abi Dawood, in his Kitab al-Masahif, page 23, notes, many of the passages of the Quran that were sent down were known by those who died on the day of Yamama, but they were not known by those who survived them, nor were they written down, nor had Abu Bakr, Umar, or Uthman by that time collected the Quran, nor were they found with even one person after them. And one of the earliest Christian responses to Islam is that of the Apology of Al-Kindi, a fascinating book. Listen to what Al-Kindi says. Then the people fell to variance in their reading. Some read according to the version of Ali, which they follow to the present day. Some read according to the collection of which we have been made mention. One party read according to the text of Ibn Mas'ud, I mentioned him to you, and another according to that of Ubay ibn Ka'b. When Uthman came to power and people everywhere differed in their reading, Ali sought grounds of accusation against him. By the way, Ali is the will become the successor of Uthman, and that's where civil war breaks out, and Ali, that line becomes the Shiites. Uthman, Abu Bakr, the others become the Sunnis. This is where the division takes place. This is why this is so very important. One man would read a verse one way and another man another way, and there was change in interpolation, some copies having more and some less, which is true. Ibn Mas'ud, Ubay ibn Ka'b's Quran had a different number of surahs than the current Quran has. When this was represented to Uthman and the danger urged of division, strife, and apostasy, he thereupon caused to be collected together all the leaves and scraps that he could, together with the copy that was written out at first. Remember, this is a Christian. This is a Christian who has access to the same information that Sahih al-Bukhari had access to about 50 to 100 years later. But they did not interfere with that which was in the hands of Ali or of those who followed his reading. Ubay was dead by this time. As for Ibn Mas'ud, they demanded his exemplar, but he refused to give it up. He did resist the Uthmanic revision. It is reported from Ismail ibn Ibrahim, from Ayyub, from Nafi, from Ibn Umar, who said, "Let none of you say, I have acquired the whole of the Quran." How does he know that what all of it is when much of the Quran has disappeared? Rather, let him say, "I have acquired what has survived of the Quran." Another, that's actually from an Islamic source. Now, very quickly, many Muslims believe the Quran has no meaningful textual history. The Quran they possess today is a mirror image of Uthman's revision. But the fact is that there are textual variants in the early copies of the Quran and evidence of an early editing process seeking to remove Ibn Mas'ud and Ubay ibn Ka'b's influence upon the text. I only have a chance to show you two examples of this, but let me tell you something. First of all, if you've listened carefully to what I've told you right now, you already know more about the Quran than 99.87% of all Christians in the world. That's a sad fact. That's a sad fact. But you also know more about the history of the Quran than most Muslims, too, because they do not inquire in the vast majority of instances into the history of their own book. Then again, how many Christians inquire into the history of theirs? Real easy to, you know, put the shoe back on the other foot. But let me tell you something. Seeing these variants is going to put you in a very small group, very select group of people who have ever seen this kind of material. For example, in Surah 2, 222 provides another example, this time based upon the Fogg's Palimpsest manuscript. A palimpsest is a manuscript where the original writing has been washed off and another version or a completely different work written on the washed parchment or leather. Using ultraviolet light, we can often read the original reading. When we read the original text in the Fogg's manuscript, Surah 2, 222, which I have here on the top, and compare the current edition, we see not just variation, we see wholesale editing. Words are changed, the word order is changed, verbal forms are altered, grammatical terminations are changed, etc. This is clear evidence of the continued attempt, at least a century after Uthman, of ridding the Quran of the readings of Ibn Mas'ud. And so you can see the changes in the orders, the words. This is not just simply a copyist error. This involves actual editing of the text itself. Then, very quickly, I know we're getting short, but we'll wrap up here in about five. I don't want to rush this too much. I'm very thankful for the fact that over the years, the people of God have helped me to obtain a number of resources for my library that I need for my work in Islam. Islamic books are expensive. I have two museum-quality reproductions of two of the earliest Qurans in the world, the one from the London Quran, and then this is BNF 328A, which is in the National Library in Paris, France. And this actually is a picture from my reproduction of that Quran. The Quran would be taller than this pulpit as far as height-wise and would cover the whole pulpit when it was open. It's just huge. and they were not inexpensive items to obtain, I assure you. What you can see here, you can see fairly clearly that there is a textual variant here. For example, look at all these lamads. See the angle that they're written at? Look at the lamads there. Completely different angle. You can see that something was written behind it beforehand. It's been scratched off. There is a variant here. This term became really a source of tremendous confusion at the time of Uthman. This was relevant to the concept of succession in the Islamic community. Here you see it in a little larger version. It's right here is where it is. And in this, once this variant was introduced, this change was made in the text, a commentary verse was added at the end of Surah 4 to make this make sense. But to be able to do that, the author of this manuscript had to make some editing changes. And so a little bit later on, hopefully you can see it, here is a stub. See the stub right here? That's where a page has been cut out. Now, you have to leave enough of the page, if you know how books are made, you have to leave enough of the page. If you cut it all out, the other side of the page is going to fall out the other side. So the stub has been left in. And when you look at what happens later on in the manuscript where that other page is, notice this page. See how large the lettering is here and how much space there is between? But look up here. See how small the lettering is and how it's all squished together? The author was concerned at he was having to put more text in than was originally there because he has to add that extra verse in. And it has to end at the exact same word that will start the next page. And so he's had to squish it all in to make the whole thing fit. Now, I could go into the details as to what this has to do with the whole issue of succession and Uthman and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But the point is, here you have clear evidence of textual variation in a manuscript of the Quran at an early point in its promulgation. Now, why is this important? Many Muslims will say that because there are textual variants in the Quran. Remember last night, Shabir Ali pointed out a textual variant. Anybody remember what it was? Mark 1:1. Then in Mark 1:1, there are manuscripts where the phrase "the Son of God" does not appear. He knew it off the top of his head. They will say because there are textual variants in the New Testament, and there are, all you got to do is look at the bottom of the page of your ESV, NASB, and anything else. There are going to be little notes. Say some manuscripts say this, some manuscripts say that. Because there are textual variants, then we can't trust the New Testament. What's the result of that? Well, they have to believe there aren't any textual variants in the Quran, but there are. They won't apply the same standard in regards to the Quran. But there's something more important. We may have textual variants in the New Testament because of the way it was transmitted. It was freely transmitted all across the Roman Empire. But since we have so many manuscripts, we can identify what the original text was. When you have what Uthman did, when you have the burning of early materials, when you have recension and editing, you can only be certain of the text back to that point, but not before it. And this is what Muslims do not understand. And unfortunately, there aren't very many Christians that are able to explain it to them either, even if they had the opportunity of talking about it. And so this information is there. It is available. Very, very quickly. This is why Sufyan al-Thawri's relatively short Tafsir is a commentary on the Quran, can list 67 variant readings, 24 of which are attributed to Ibn Mas'ud. The existence of these textual issues has been well known to Muslim scholars for centuries, but has fallen out of general Islamic recognition, especially in our lifetimes. For example, this is the top copy manuscript that was published in 2007. And this is just one page of the listings that the top copy manuscript provides. This is a Turkish manuscript, and most Turkish Muslims, anyways, used to be rather secular, of the variant readings in major mushaf, or manuscripts, of the Quran. There is no critical edition of the Quran yet. It's being worked on. It's called the Corpus Quranicum Project, but it does not yet exist anywhere in the world. So there you have... Oh, man, this just keeps coming in. I don't know what... I'm sorry. I'll get this fixed, really, honestly. This will get fixed eventually, but I'm not really going to work too hard on it. So there's a little bit of the history of the Quran, Muhammad placing him in where he is in history. That will give us, hopefully, the proper foundation to now look into the text of the Quran after our break and look at what it says to you and I. What does it teach about Tawheed, Shirk, Jesus, and what about the crucifixion? What about Surah 4, 157? And then we'll try to wrap it all up and tie it together at that point. Brother, it's all yours.